Well, have you ever seen one of those domino competitions, those domino toppling competitions where thousands of carefully arranged blocks tumble in a satisfying chain reaction? Have you seen those videos on YouTube? I've often wondered how many of those attempts have ended in tears. How many of those attempts ended in tears when someone knocked over one of the blocks a little early and destroyed hours of work before its time? Just one little slip-up has the potential to destroy hours of careful planning. Or you might think about Rocket Lab just over the hills here in Mahia. After months of building and design on the 5th of July, they launched a $11.5 million rocket. But one single electrical connection meant that it never made it to orbit. Just one small electrical connection failed. The most careful planning was brought to its knees by one slip-up. This was the situation that Israel was facing. God had so carefully built them up to be his people, to be a nation. He raised up Moses. He defeated Pharaoh. He provided for them food and water. He made a covenant with them as his holy and chosen people. And he prepared to dwell with them personally in a tabernacle, which was to be carefully crafted according to the instructions given in chapters 25 to 31. And then, through one careless act of idolatry, Israel near derails everything. So what I propose to do this morning is to take a good look at this sin which they have sinned, this idolatry where Israel fashioned for themselves a golden calf, an image, and worshipped it as their God. And as we study it, perhaps we'll shine some fresh light on the nature of sin, the dynamics of sin, and then also show us that sin won't have the final word. Sin does not have the power to derail God's careful planning. So let's begin with the question. What motivated Israel? What triggered Israel to sin this way? If we look at verse 1, it says, "When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, 'Up, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him.'" Now, even though this nation had experienced God undeniably, they've seen God part waters in front of them. They have enjoyed his provisions along the way. They have actually heard his voice from Mount Sinai. They still grew impatient toward Moses being somewhere else, being somewhere with God where they were not. It seemed as though God had become out of reach, even though they had experienced him so undeniably. And so what Israel did is that they looked for a new leader, Aaron, and made a god that they could reach, the golden calf. And this degradation into sin was nurtured in the soils of impatience. They were impatient for Moses and for God. And so they sin. There's a lesson here for us, of course. There is a lesson here for us. Impatience often triggers a sinful response in us, doesn't it? A good number of us know this just from personal experience. Maybe you've experienced it even just in the last few days. If you've ever been in a long queue and you have a deadline to meet, your doctor is running late with appointments, or your warrant of fitness is taking too long, You know the kind of sin that impatience can expose in us. You know how your anger begins to rise and the strong and ingracious internal conversation that begins to take place, and that irritability which you then proceed to take out on the various receptionists. You know that impatience triggers sinful responses. Our impatience stirs up a sinful response within us, and Israel well demonstrates this. They grew impatient, and so they sin. Watch out. Watch out, therefore, when you become impatient, that you do not sin also. That said, we would be mistaken to categorize Israel's sin only in terms of external, visible behavior. It would be a mistake to think that simply building the calf and worshipping it is their great mistake, is the biggest issue in this passage. It is a big deal for sure, but it is not the biggest issue going on. If we do this, if we categorize sin as merely what we can see, the external behaviors of a person or people, we will adopt a very superficial view of sin. We will think that sin is merely an external product to us, rather than an internal aspect of our nature. So for instance, if we have a superficial view of sin, we think that we could banish all kinds of sin by merely applying enough external pressure, enough framework to stop people from engaging in those sins. We think we can stop the sin of abortion if we outlaw abortion. We think that we think that homosexuality and pornography will be addressed if we prosecute sexuality which differs from the scriptures. We think that taxing people out of their lawfully gained wealth will eradicate greed. We think that cultural and moral decay in society can be halted if just more people voted conservative, right? All these ways, we think if we just apply external factors, we can deal with sin adequately. But that is a mistake. It is a mistake to think of sin as merely external things which can be eradicated through pressure. To treat sin this way, to treat sin as merely something that you ought to cut off at the external level, to stop people from sinning externally, is to treat sin the way an amateur gardener treats a weed. I'm an amateur gardener, so I know a thing or two about this. To treat sin as merely the outside visible things is to treat sin the way a gardener treats a weed. We snip away at the things that we can see. We snip away at the leaves and the blades that we can see, making our garden look nice for a week or so, but we never really kill the weed. We have cut off stems of it, but it will come back. Weeds do this. I remember years ago, living in the bottom of the South Island, we had a garden patch in the middle of our lawn, and this was going to be where we grew our strawberries and our beans for the season. But there were weeds everywhere, and I found some Perspex screens, and I put them on the ground, and the heat of the sunlight just killed off everything underneath, and I was so very pleased with my efforts. I was so very pleased that I had killed off everything, leaving only dirt underneath these Perspex screens. But as soon as I lifted the screens, no more than a week later, these weeds revived. They were back. I had never really dealt with them. I merely killed off what I could see, but the real issue was the root. It was still there. The same goes for sin. Suppressing it, merely killing it off at the surface level, may look like we have got it under control, but eventually we're going to have to get out a spade and deal with it, roots and all. But where is the root of sin? Where do we dig to find the real problem? Where do we dig to find the problem of sin? John Calvin helpfully explained it this way. He said in his Institutes, we may gather that man's nature, so to speak, is a perpetual factory of idols. Man tries to express in his work the sort of God he has inwardly conceived. Therefore, the mind begets the idol and the hand gives it birth. Following Calvin's thought, he rightly recognized that sin is firstly an inward problem. It is inside our nature. Said another way, sin is not simply a set of external behaviors that we indulge, but flows from an inward disposition towards sin. And connecting this to our text, Israel was not merely sinning by visibly violating the second commandment. Their visible violation of God's commandment demonstrates an inward corruption. It is evidence that they are inwardly corrupt in nature, that they are in fact a perpetual factory of idol makers at heart. It is this kind of sinful disposition that all humanity has to face up to, that we do not desire God, we do not desire his holy law, and we do not desire him to instruct our obedience. It is that kind of insight which is very helpful, because it teaches us, if we are to really deal with sin, if we are really going to get at it, we need to do more than appear to be merely good, well-behaved people. There is more to dealing with sin, really dealing with sin, than being a good, well-behaved, moral person. We actually need our sinfully corrupt nature to be completely uprooted and replaced. We need a complete overhaul if we are going to deal with sin properly. This is what God begins to do in us through the gospel. This is what God begins to do through us in the gospel. By trusting the gospel of Jesus crucified for our sin, we are declaring, we are making it plain to God and ourselves that we are utterly unable to deal with sin ourselves. We do not have the resources, the tools, we do not have the spade to dig it out. We must trust God to do it for us. And so when we declare our inability to deal with sin by trusting in this gospel of Jesus Christ crucified for our sin, that is where God brings forgiveness, life, and renewal to our sinfully corrupt nature. That is what God begins to do us through the gospel of Jesus Christ. Another area then I want you to get to grips with or come to terms with in the text is to highlight that Israel's sin was not actually blatantly irreligious. Right, we think of sin as blatantly irreligious, something completely devoid of looking anything God-like or trying to imitate God in any kind of way. But I want you to see that Israel's sin was actually a parody. It was a parody of true religion. Sin works this way. It takes what is good and right, and then distorts it. We have something. We know something of this in our household with Lego. So our kids know that there is true and good Lego, but they also know that there are cheap knockoffs of Lego floating around. Easily accessible because it's cheap, and it looks similar. It looks similar, but really, as you may know, cheap Lego is a poor parody of the genuine article. It looks similar, but it's not quite it, is it? It doesn't quite last as long, and the spelling is off on the boxes. You know this. So we know this from life experience, that sin, the design of sin is to imitate, to parody, to mimic true religion. And you see this in verses 2 through to 6. There was gold. When they were creating their idol, there was gold. It was a material which was featured very heavily in the tabernacle of God which was now going to be redeployed in the use of idol making. There was also an altar, complete with burnt offerings and peace offerings, parroting the covenant which God had made with Israel in Exodus 24. There was feasting, echoing the feast meal Israel's elders had with God. All the while, their sin is mimicking true and good religion. But perhaps the most shocking of all of this is Israel ascribing God's own words of deliverance to their idol. They were attributing what God had done for them to their idol. You see this in verse 4. And Aaron received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. And they said, These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Sin is like this. Sin plagiarizes. Sin mimics. Sin imitates good and genuine gifts from God. It does. It mimics. It has nothing original to offer, only distorted versions of the good and genuine gifts of God. Of this, Timothy Keller wrote in his very helpful book, Counterfeit Gods. He writes, "We think that idols are bad things, but that's almost never the case. Anything can serve as a counterfeit God, especially the very best things in life. Anything that absorbs your heart and imagination more than God. Anything you seek to give you what only God can give you." In this way, Israel was seeking from their graven image a parody of God, what only God could actually give them. They were seeking from this idol true identity and atonement and salvation and fellowship and worship. But these are the things that only God could actually give them. And we all struggle with this, don't we? We all struggle with this. I struggle with this. Perpetually, we are lured by the cheap knockoffs that sin sets before us. The cheap knockoffs of the good and genuine gifts of God. And it lures us with easy access to these things, promising to give us what only God can truly give. And because we indulge this, because we so easily fall away from God truly into idolatry, perhaps this will help you see why God responded so severely to this incident. In verses 9 through to 10, God said to Moses, "I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people." That just means they're stubborn as heck. Elsewhere, it calls them iron-sinewed people. They just refuse to turn to God. "Now, therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them in order that I may make a great nation of you." These are very uncomfortable and severe words. This God, who so graciously received and rescued Israel, provided for her and made covenant with her as a holy nation, is now on the verge of disowning idolatrous Israel and starting his whole project from scratch with Moses as the head of the new family tree. The cynic in us thinks this God to be overly crabby or highly irritable. That's what the cynic in us reads these texts and says, well, God is very crabby God indeed and very irritable. He's like a child who throws his toys about when he doesn't get what he wants. Others think this God is wholly irreconcilable with the gracious Jesus of the New Testament. Look, I get it. I get it. These are difficult verses. And we live in times that do not have a great capacity for the severity of God. Culturally speaking, we simply do not want God to be this way. Culturally speaking, we do not want God to be this way. But if we adopt these views of God, that the God of the Old Testament is crabby and wholly different from the God Jesus reveals, aren't we making the same mistake as Israel? Aren't we making the same mistake as Israel? Aren't we exchanging the true God for a God that fits our own preference and description, much like the golden calf fit Israel's preference and description of God? I'm just asking. Perhaps this lies at the heart of our resistance to God's severity and God's response to Israel, who were so quick to turn their backs on covenant love for God. Additionally, we must also realize that all sin, not just explicit idolatry like that, solicits a severe response from God. God is indeed displeased by our acts of sin. Therefore, as Hebrews 10 says, it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Christians, I plead with you, you must not make light of this truth, nor trivialize it or overlook it. It is a truth borne out in Scripture. And yet, as this passage shows, there is also hope. There is also hope. Sin will not have the final word. Sin will not derail God's plans. There is still a way forward for ancient Israel. Yes, they fell into rank idolatry. Yes, they turned their backs on God very quickly and almost at the first opportunity, it would seem. And yet there is a way forward. God will not actually abandon them. The way forward, however, is found up the mountain. It is found toward God, where Moses was. See, God made Moses fully aware of the delinquency of Israel's idolatry and the fitting judgment on it. Moses is fully aware from the mouth of God that there's terrible things happening in the camp of Israel, and this is what God is now proposing to do, to start again. But notice Moses' plea to God in verses 30 to 32. Moses said to the people, "You have sinned a great sin, and now I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." So Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Alas, this people have sinned a great sin. They have made for themselves gods of gold. But now, if you will forgive their sins, but if not, please blot me out of your book that you have written." I want you to notice two things. Moses says, "Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." I want you to note that. Moses is offering himself for atonement. And we see that repeated in the phrase that he asked God to blot him out for the sake of Israel. Moses recognized idolatry was a great sin requiring nothing short of full atonement. The atonement that Moses had in mind is far more than the animal sacrifices which they have been taught by God. Moses offered his own life in exchange for the Israelites. In this way, Moses foreshadows Jesus. Moses foreshadows Jesus. Moses is prefiguring Jesus. Moses is a type of Jesus as he offered to fling himself into the path of God's judgment in order to obtain the salvation of Israel. Here, his intention is Christ-like. Moses' intention is Christ-like. But God does not accept Moses' offer. Why? Why does God not accept Moses' offer? It's not because God doesn't like the idea of substitutionary atonement. We know this from the scriptures. Rather, Moses was not able to bear the weight of that calling. Moses is not the one that will be designated as the good substitute to atone and gain salvation for others. Why? Because Moses too was just a human being stained by sin, in whose heart there is a perpetual factory of idols at work. His life too needed to be redeemed by a substitute. And yet a true and better and more capable Moses would one day come along. A true and better, more capable Moses would one day come along. His name, Jesus. And this Jesus tells us that he came to do what Moses could not do. In John 10, we find these words from Jesus. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Like Moses, Jesus desires the salvation of God's people, and he gladly offers himself in their place. This is why Jesus was crucified, doing what Moses could not do. And because God has accepted Jesus' offering for sin, diverting God's rightful anger, our future with God is now never in jeopardy. We are his and he is ours. God has made peace with us through Jesus Christ, and we live in the liberating grace of God perpetually. We war against our sin, yes. We boldly confess when we do sin, yes. And we go on receiving mercy, tireless mercy from God, from now into eternity. Let me pray for us.